This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The House of Commons is set to study an independent senator's bill that would require Canadians to verify their age to access porn online.
This bill originated in the Senate in 2021, and it says in its title exactly what it's proposing. It's called an act to restrict young persons' online access to sexually explicit material. It argues that for young people, consuming sexually explicit content is linked to serious harms, like addiction, gender stereotypes, and can shape their attitudes about harassment and violence.
Bill S-210, the controversial age verification bill, which purports to limit access to pornography for those under 18, could be headed for a final vote of approval in the House of Commons within the next couple of weeks. Much of the concern with the bill has focused on the privacy and free speech implications of mandating the technology and opening the door to website blocking. Yet often missing from the debate has been a deeper, more nuanced examination of pornography, including distinctions between unlawful and so-called awful but lawful content, the role and responsibility of pornography platforms, and alternatives to the S-210 reliance on blocking and age verification technologies. That gap in the debate has now been filled by Professor Elaine Craig of the Schulich School of Law at Dalhousie University in her new book, Mainstreaming Porn. Professor Craig joins me on the podcast to discuss the book, the massive influence of porn platforms, and the legal mechanisms she thinks would best address the issue. Spoiler alert, it isn't Bill S-210, which she thinks won't work and may cause more harm than good. Elaine, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for joining me. You know, just as a preface, as I was preparing for this podcast and having read your book, I was thinking back to when I appeared before the Senate on Bill S-210, the age verification bill that we're certainly going to talk a bit about, or had Senator Julie Melville Deschaine on this podcast as a guest earlier this year. The starting point was always that I was asked to concede as a critic of that bill that access to pornography for those under 18 was a problem. And there certainly are concerns, legitimate concerns, and I'm sure we'll come to some of those. It's the way the question is framed doesn't really allow for much nuance. And I have to say that I wish I had your book when I appeared on the issue. The book Mainstreaming Porn, which you just published with McGill Queens University Press, identifies really some genuine concerns with pornography, but I think even more some of the pornography platforms. And I know we're going to talk quite a lot about that. But it also engages in a real balanced discussion on the issue and the need for effective legal mechanisms to deal with those platforms. So there's a lot here. It's a book that I really recommend, but I want to focus on three things in particular. First, the role of those pornography platforms, and we'll get into some of your recommendations for legal responses to both unlawful pornography and, I think, borrowing a bit from some of the online harms discussion, lawful but awful pornography. You know, let's start, though, with the platforms. And you note that much of the platform regulation debate has focused on the big giants, the Googles and Facebooks of the world, but oftentimes omits the pornography platforms, notably MindGeek. Can you provide a bit of background on just how big these platforms are and how wide their usage is?
Yeah, so these platforms are massive. They are as ubiquitous as Facebook or Amazon. MindGeek, you mentioned, or ALO as it has been rebranded, which is a Canadian company, owns many porn streaming platforms, including Pornhub, which is, I think, the world's largest, but also porn studios and other related companies. In terms of how wide their usage is, according to some studies, these platforms are visited as often or more often than, you know, very popular websites like Wikipedia, platforms like Netflix, Pornhub, again, the largest, I think, which is just one platform, reported in 2019, 115 million visits per day. And they've reported 4 million Canadians a day. So that's about 10% of the Canadian population that's visiting Pornhub every day, if its data is accurate.
That's pretty staggering from a numbers perspective, I have to say. But you note in the book that it's about more than just the viewership, that the platforms like this are actually changing pornography itself in some important ways. How so?
Yeah, I think largely related to the change in their business model. So these porn streaming platforms are to a large extent designed and operated the same in the same way as other social media sites, with a kind of community building objective explicitly articulated. They brand themselves in that way. And so individuals can sign up to be members or models depending on the platform. You can like content, rate content, comment on videos. On some platforms, you can upload your own videos. And so one of the arguments that I make is that that's brought a sort of quasi-communal element to mainstream porn consumption, and that the result of that is an amplification of its normative impact in non-virtual settings. And like other platforms, these ones are data-driven. So they collect data about everything that users do on the platform. In part, again, because the business model relies on advertising for a significant portion of its revenue. But the result of this, though, is that algorithms are shaping or informing the mainstream porn that people consume. And while I would say not all porn is problematic, the result of this kind of algorithm-driven consumption can have some problematic outcomes.
Okay, interesting. Now, the policies of these platforms, I think, is going to figure quite prominently in some of the recommendations that we're going to come to in a minute. But you had cited some interesting data about how users perceive that all the content on the platforms is lawful and how those policies, said to which they're reading those policies, may actually reinforce that perception. Can you unpack a little bit what you see taking place?
Yeah, that's a great point to highlight. So some of the research that I looked at suggests that the majority or even the vast majority of porn consumers or mainstream porn consumers say that they've never seen porn that they interpret as sexual violence or non-consensual, or that they've only seen that kind of content once or twice. So folks interpret the representations of sex that they're consuming as consensual ones. And if you contrast that with research, like for example, there's a study out of the UK in 2021. They looked at 150,000 videos on the again mainstream platforms, and found that one in eight had titles that framed the content as sexual violence. That doesn't mean that the videos themselves necessarily depicted sexual violence, but it framed the content that way, these titles, one in eight. And so and certainly my research, while not, I wasn't making quantitative claims, but I certainly in the research that I did found lots of depictions of sexualized violence that were readily available on mainstream platforms. And so I think if you think about that, if what that suggests, if you think about what users, how they're interpreting the content that they consume and that type of finding, it suggests a pretty significant disjuncture between what users are seeing and interpreting. And the policies and user agreements, terms of service on mainstream platforms, I think probably, arguably reinforce that disjuncture, which, others like Professor Vera Gray have argued that that's the author of the study that I just referred to. So these mainstream platforms have user agreements and policies that very clearly prohibit non-consensual content, including real or simulated sex, including, not only content that is non-consensual, but content that depicts non-consensual sexual activities. So fictional representations of sexual assault or of other sexual offenses, other illegal conduct. Presumably, these policies represent to users as if you said, like you say, if they actually read them, which is obviously an open question, that the content on these sites depicts consensual sex. And so the risk, with a disjuncture like this is that it either feeds a harmful and erroneous narrative, not an uncommon one, frankly, about the supposed difficulty of distinguishing between consensual and non-consensual sex, or even worse, perhaps, it reinforces erroneous understandings of consent, right? That people, may not understand that the actual legal definition of consent. So a good example in the Canadian context being content that depicts men initiating sexual acts on women who are depicted as asleep or unconscious. That's illegal in Canada. That's illegal in our law of sexual offense, law of sexual assault, pardon me. But that's content that I found readily available on these platforms when I did my research.
Okay. I mean, that provides a perfect segue into this notion of unlawful porn and distinguishing between lawful and unlawful. Now, we know politicians have been really almost forever, it seems, trying to limit access to pornography, despite given the numbers that you cited, that's pretty readily apparent demand for it. Focus is very often on protecting minors. And your analysis points, as I say, to the need to think about this content and it's in one bucket of some of it being unlawful and then some of it being lawful but still raising some potential harms. We'll talk a bit about the lawful but awful content, and I think that's where Bill S-210, the age verification bill, comes in. But let's first start with unlawful. I think you've just described it a little bit. Can you expand a bit on what unlawful pornography is?
Yeah, so I think in Canada, loosely speaking, there's sort of four categories of unlawful porn. So you have obscenity provisions or prohibitions in the criminal code. You have child sexual abuse material or what's described in the criminal code as child pornography. And you have content that's produced or distributed without the consent of all of those appearing in it. So that's the intimate images, non-consensual intimate images, like some of the content that's targeted by some of the legislation that I think we'll probably talk about in a moment. And then lastly, at least currently, content that violates hate speech prohibitions under the criminal law.
Okay.
That's how I would sort of categorize unlawful, so-called unlawful porn in Canada, anyway.
Okay. And you've identified three primary recommendations, which I have to say share a considerable amount of overlap with Bill C-63, the online harms bill that is currently working its way through the House of Commons. Can you explain how you think we could be seeking to address that kind of pornography, the stuff that falls into the unlawful bucket?
Yes, okay. And so I should say, all of my suggestions are primarily targeted at platforms, not at individual users. The obvious starting place, I suppose, is the criminal law, which I actually think has been, pretty ineffective, in terms of responding to the problematic aspects of pornography. And I think there's a pretty limited role for the criminal law here. So, platforms like Pornhub today, maybe not true 4 years ago, but today are likely, less likely to have child sexual abuse material on them, perhaps even than, say, a site like Facebook. So there's some role for, obviously we need, rigid and to the extent possible, visually enforced child pornography laws. But to expand on that in terms of criminal law, at least targeted at platforms, I think we should use the criminal law to prosecute platforms for content that promotes or celebrates, intrafamily sexual abuse. So that's a subset of what has become, thanks to, I think, algorithm-driven content promotion, has become a very popular form of porn is incest-themed porn. So porn that some of which is not related to sexualized violence, but some of which eroticizes, the sexual assault of say sleeping stepsisters and fictional depictions of the sexual abuse of children by stepfathers. And so While this content for those, who are under 18 already, I think meets the definition of child pornography in Canadian criminal law, according to some case law, Bill C-63 would actually make even clearer that this is unlawful, or at least according to its definition, harmful content that platforms have to take steps to mitigate against. So the definition of the content under the bill, that sexual content that sexually victimizes a child includes a person depicted as a child engaged in sexual activity. And I think that would cover this subset of what is, I found, I'll just speak for myself. I found very surprising when I started doing this research, how incredibly popular incest-themed porn, again, not all of it is eroticizing sexual violence, but a prominent subset of it is, how popular it is. And so the subset of it that does, in, as I said, depict fictional accounts of interfamily sexual abuse, I think would be explicitly targeted by C-63. So that's my first recommendation is how to deal with some of the problem aspects through criminal law. Second is civil law. So how do we use the civil law to deal with content that's produced or distributed without consent? So again, this is the consensual distribution of intimate images, or revenge porn, as it's sometimes problematically called. And so again, Bill C-63 actually targets this to some extent, obviously, as well. Particularly though, if it is not enacted, I think it's critical that provinces adopt or revise their intimate images statutes to accord with some of the recommendations that folks like Professor Emily Laidlaw and Hilary Young have made in their Uniform Non-Disclosure of Intimate Images Act. So they've got a uniform sort of a model statute, and it's actually one that British Columbia has adopted. I think PEI's is maybe based on it as well, which creates a sort of fast and accessible process for victims to obtain, declaratory relief, a remedy, ordering that their images be taken down, destroyed, de-indexed, fast track that. And lots of other provinces have intimate images protection acts, but they don't create that sort of process. In addition to that, these statutes, like the one in BC and the one that Professor Laidlaw and Young propose, they also allow victims to seek compensation, right? A more traditional remedy. But typically, that exempts liability for platforms if they've, taken all reasonable steps to prevent to prevent this from happening, to prevent users from uploading intimate images without consent. And so that's the kind of provision, whether it's in Bill C-63 or whether it's in these provincial statutes, we need courts to properly understand how this type of immunity would work or should work in terms of liability for porn streaming platforms in particular. So Bill C-63 obviously covers all sorts of platforms, right? Not just the ones that I'm focused on. But what's reasonable for these platforms in terms of preventative measures, which is an objective standard under these statutes, what's reasonable for them regarding non-consensual images has got to be assessed in light of, the risks that they pose given the nature of their business. So porn streaming platforms, given what, what they do, they create a greater risk of intimate images abuse than, Airbnb or Amazon. And so they have to be required to take substantially more onerous steps. Now, a platform like Pornhub already does that, although according to Canada's Privacy Commissioner, in the report that he released last February, the steps that Pornhub is taking in this respect continue to be inadequate, according to him. But if Bill C-63 is enacted, and this duty to act responsibly by mitigating, the risk of users doing this, of uploading this content, or the risk that other users will be exposed to it, is interpreted in the manner that I'm suggesting, or incorporated into the regulations in this way, then I think the Online Harms Act would put in place some of these same safeguards. But the key really is that we understand what reasonable means in the context of the specific types of platforms I'm talking about. And then lastly, the third recommendation that I make involves hate speech and the use of human rights law. Now, I know that that has been a controversial aspect of C63, along with the kind of draconian sentencing provisions for hate crimes that it proposes. What I'm proposing is somewhat different, though. First of all, I don't know that it needs to be wrapped into what is essentially a different piece of legislation, the Online Harms Act. But setting that aside, what I'm suggesting is actually a revision to the Canadian Human Rights Act that would enable claims that are targeted at hate speech engaged in by platforms rather than individual users, sort of the opposite actually of what's proposed. So for platforms' own speech, and so what I'm arguing is that there's a form of hate speech that platforms engage in that's manifested through their use of metadata. So through the titles and tags and categories and search capacities on these platforms and the way in which that metadata is marshaled by the platform. And I use lots of examples in the book into sort of a, it's sort of curated into a kind of taxonomy of hatred, in which I think the platforms themselves are engaging in hate speech by linking concepts in potentially misogynistic or racist ways. Again, not all metadata, but a subset. And again, without getting too far into the weeds, I think there's a way that we could design an amendment and a process under human rights legislation that would avoid some of the pitfalls that people have identified with the earlier iteration of that law in the Federal Act. So Richard Moon, for example, wrote a report in the early 2000s identifying some of the concerns with what was Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. I think because what I'm suggesting would be targeted at platforms, not individuals, I don't know that it would raise the same issues around chilling speech, backlog, vexatious complainers. And the advantage would be that more systemic remedies for an approach that actually matches what is a much broader issue than the content or the titles and tags that any one individual user is uploading to one of these platforms.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly a proposal that is sure to evoke a lot of debate, and that's for sure. I mean, Richard Moon came on this podcast to talk specifically about his report and in the context of C63 some time ago. So it's undoubtedly controversial, but the way in which you've turned many of these kinds of remedies or potential reforms and focus them very specifically on the platforms, I think, is one of the really notable takeaways. And I think comes in contrast not just to C63, but in contrast a bit to Bill S-210 as well, which has been it's really in some ways the current legislative proposal that seeks to deal with these issues. It sort of went through the Senate somewhat unscathed and is at the precipice, it would seem, potentially being passed in the House, even though the government finds itself opposed to it. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I've been really harshly critical about this bill and mandating age verification on both privacy and freedom of expression grounds. You're also critical of it, and you talk a bit about the bill both in the book, and you talked about it as well in a recent op-ed in the Globe and Mail. And part of your emphasis has been on your view that it simply won't work. Can you explain why you think that?
Yeah, so the studies that I've read suggest that while younger adolescents and kids, children may s accidentally stumble upon sexual content online or be exposed by a friend or sibling, it's about age 16 when young people actually seek porn out. And by age 16, the vast majority of young people, again, based on the research that I looked at, are tech savvy enough to use or figure out how to use tools like VPNs, for example, to evade, these kinds of age blocks. And yes, I know that there are other tech mechanisms, there are geolocators and mechanisms to prevent VPNs. But I think, I think experience teaches us that that's a kind of cat and mouse game when it comes to trying to lock down the internet, particularly perhaps for teenagers. And that as these kind of, for example, proxy detection tools are developed, more tech will be created to overcome them. And so, because the research that I've looked at suggests we don't need this legal mechanism for young children, they're not on porn platforms or seeking out this content. For those parents who are concerned about children stumbling upon this material on search engines or platforms like Twitter, they can use safe search and parental controls. And for those, I mean, then the argument is, well, kids can figure out how to evade those parental controls. True, that's exactly right. And by the time they're old enough to figure out how to do that, they will also be old enough to figure out how to use VPNs and Tor browsers. This law will not prevent 16 and 17-year-old guys, and they are the young people who are on these mainstream platforms, from watching porn online. But what it might do, I think, Michael, is drive them to use riskier VPNs or move on to more problematic porn sites. So I really think that we can't use technology to respond to this particular social issue. We've got to use pedagogy here, not technology.
Okay. And so why don't we come to that? So essentially you're saying whether it's VPNs or perhaps even earlier on some of the parental controls, neither of these are really going to stop someone who's sufficiently tech savvy. And I think we recognize that that's the case for essentially the use group that we're thinking about here, leaving aside all the other sorts of issues that use group also, if you're engaged in certain kinds of age verification, the idea that you can distinguish between that 16 or 17-year-old and someone who's 18 and do it through some automated process seems just fanciful. I mean, it's just fiction to think that that's the case. So there are a lot of problems with the technology.
And other problems that might perpetuate, pardon me, I cut you off, but it's just, some, biases, race-based biases, or I mean, there's just a lot of problems with that technology. And I think the consensus, I mean, you would know this better than me, but is that it's just that can that technology is not developed in a way that would make it appropriate to operationalize it.
I think that's right now. I mean, the notion that we would move ahead with legislation at a time when even the privacy commissioner is still studying this technology, and we've got other jurisdictions that have come out and saying that it's just not ready, at least not right now, for the kind of implementation that's envisioned by this legislation, ought to be just such an obvious cautionary tale about moving ahead. But yet, as we were saying, the prospect of a vote on this literally in the next couple of weeks seems entirely possible. Let me essentially close with one other very large question, which is, if not Bill S-210, then what? It's basically the question that I got asked, I think, by Ville Duchesne when she appeared on the podcast. And I know you've got a couple of proposals that seek to deal with that, focused a bit on discussion and education, and I think you make some really important points there, as well, again, by turning more of the focus on what the pornography platform themselves do. Can you talk a bit about how you would go about trying to address some of these concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one is what you said or mentioned first, which is education and dialogue. I think we need to become much more concrete and skills-based about the way we talk and teach kids about porn. And when I say that, I mean genuine porn literacy, not public health warning type abolitionist messaging, but rather the ability to ask questions about what they're consuming, knowledge. That there are different types of porn, awareness that some of what they may be consuming may involve non-consensual images. I think we have to, give young people the tools to distinguish between, porn that seems overwhelmingly dominated by male sexual pleasure and porn that's more balanced. But we also need to advance porn literacy for others, for service providers and future professionals, educators, social workers, lawyers, judges, doctors. And then secondly, again, I think my focus shifts back, like you say, to platforms and content moderation. So I would say, again, there's nothing inherently harmful about porn, and not all porn is problematic. Platforms like Pornhub have very strong content moderation policies. So prohibitions on non-consensual content, a very strong community standards document, a hate speech policy, Nearly all of the content that I take issue with in this book is contrary to a platform like that's own policies. And so we need to use law to the extent possible to hold platforms, porn platforms, accountable when they fail to enforce their own content moderation policies. And on my read of it, the proposed Online Harms Act, as it's currently drafted, w would address some of that content, but it isn't, I think, sufficiently responsive to an important portion of the content that I take issue with. And mainly what I'm thinking of here is, I think it could do more to push mainstream platforms that want to be accountable or appear accountable, to take steps to mitigate against the risk that people will be consuming depictions of sexual violence involving not just children but also women, and that depictions of what are sexual offenses under our criminal code would be the most obvious example. And so, I say that largely because of the definition of harmful content under the proposed legislation. I do think there are other pieces of that bill, though, that are hopeful and that would move things forward.
So, you make the point in the book that pornography is one of those things that an awful lot of people like to watch, but are far less comfortable talking about. And both through your book and now through this discussion, you demonstrated there is the possibility to certainly both talk about it and then talk about the kinds of approaches we might think about from a legal and policy perspective to distinguish between different kinds of pornography and different kinds of harms and how we might go about dealing with it. With a particular emphasis, as you've suggested throughout, in dealing with the platform. So, thank you so much for both the book and taking the time to come on and discussing an important issue and one that I think will very much be in the spotlight in the House of Commons in just the next week or two.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a very, very much an honor.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.